From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with Listen, the podcast that highlights the common threads that run through different cultures and unite us as human beings. We're thrilled to bring you another conversation in our adventure series. In today's interview, we'll be talking about various aspects of challenges, interior and exterior, spiritual and physical, together and as individuals, against the backdrop of the Camino de Santiago in northern Spain. A brief note before we begin. I myself hiked the Camino in the summer of 2001 at the age of 30. It was on that trip that I met and fell in love with the man who would become my husband. In January of 2002, I moved to Spain to be with him and have lived here ever since. Today I'm joined by Tom Sesma and Penny Dalton. Tom Sesma is a New Yorker and an actor who has appeared in many productions on and off Broadway and on U.S. television. His work has also been seen in many American regional theaters. In 1999, he appeared in the national tour of Titanic the Musical with Yours Truly. He also teaches acting at the Einhorn School for Performing Arts at Primary Stages, one of New York's notable off-Broadway theaters. Penny Dalton is the company manager for the Roundabout Theater Company's upcoming production of Caroline or Change, which will be her 26th Broadway show. She's the vice president of the Association of Theatrical Press Agents and Managers and is an adjunct professor at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, the alma mater of Yours Truly. Tom and Penny live in Manhattan with their dog Willie and cat Xavier. In 2016, and again in 2019, they walked the Camino de Santiago. Penny and Tom, welcome to the Listen podcast.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. Great to talk to you again after all these years.
It is great to reconnect and finally meet Penny, who I've heard so much about, and finally talk to you about the Camino.
Yes.
So let's start with a basic question, just so we're on the same page, all our listeners are on the same page. What is the Camino de Santiago?
The Camino de Santiago is a hundreds years old pilgrimage route through, there are many routes, but the Camino de Santiago ends in Santiago de Compostela.
Christian pilgrims have three great pilgrimage routes throughout history, pilgrimage to Jerusalem, a pilgrimage to Rome, and a pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela. And that began at the end of the 9th century when the Western nations, Western kingdoms, started to reclaim Spain during the Reconquista. Pilgrims all over Europe would walk to Santiago de Compostela to revere the remains of Santiago, the apostle, who is buried underneath the cathedral at Santiago de Compostela. The pilgrimage route has remained popular for many, many centuries since then, and in the 20th century particularly, it has become even more popular.
Wow, thank you so much. Thank you so much for putting us all on the same page. And just one thing I want to make clear, Santiago is St. James in English.
Right.
So his remains are believed to be in northwest Spain, and this amazing, amazing cathedral over the years and over the centuries has been erected where his, you know, on the site of his tomb.
Right.
And so, yes, in a nutshell, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, for your listeners who are not Christian or not Catholic, the reason St. James, Santiago, is so important is that he is a He was an apostle, one of the 12 apostles. And so the reason his remains are so important is that it is through Santiago, the person, that there is a direct line to Jesus Christ and the New Testament.
Ah, okay. Not even I knew that. So thank you. Thank you. Tom, you told me in preparation for this interview, and I think on some level I knew this, but that you are a religious person, mm-hmm. that your reasons for doing the Camino were, you know, if you had to put it in a nutshell, were religious. And Penny, I believe that your reasons were a little bit different. Is that right?
I think my reasons were more, I guess I would qualify them as spiritual and mm-hmm. and more of a personal need or journey and not as much rooted in religion. I was brought up Catholic, but I'm not as fervent a practicing Catholic as Tom is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there were still touch points for me from my Catholic upbringing, but it was more of an overall spiritual experience for me, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of my story as well. Raised Catholic, definitely a spiritual person, and you know, I've always been very interested in that. I mean, obviously, religion and spirituality are very closely linked, and in the most ideal moments and in the most ideal terms, religion comes from spirituality. You know, all the dogma sprouts from that organic mm-hmm. place of spirituality. Tell us, please, how you heard about the Camino and how that spark was lit. And as you mentioned, Tom, the Camino is a network of paths all throughout Europe, all of which ultimately lead to Santiago. So, you know, how you heard about the Camino, how you became interested, and how you chose which of these paths you would ultimately take.
Oh my gosh, you could write a book about this. Because I've been so interested in spirituality and religion my whole life, even though I spent decades away from the Catholic Church, I'm now a practicing Catholic again. I've always been fascinated by the idea of the pilgrimage experience, you know, the whole idea of people of different faiths just, you know, walking to a certain place, to a certain destination in order to find something deeply spiritual. You have these monks in Thailand who don't even have a monastery. They just walk. Faith of Islam, you have the Hajj, the annual Hajj. You could say that the people of the Jewish faith have been on a pilgrimage for their entire existence. And then, as I said earlier, there are these three great Christian pilgrimages in Christian history: Jerusalem, Rome, and Santiago. But I was familiar with the Camino de Santiago, I think it was 2010, I saw a movie called The Way, which I think most Americans who walk the Camino now have been inspired to explore the idea of walking the Camino because of that film. I saw the film. I was working in Las Vegas doing Disney's The Lion King out there in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And Penny and I were a couple, except she was working in New York. And I called her immediately after I saw the film and I said, "Oh, you have to go see this movie. And I'll leave it to you."
Right. So it ended up being shown here in a very small theater. And I went soon after. And I literally walked out of the theater, picked up my phone. I think I was crying. I called Tom and I said, "We have to do this. Like, we have to go do this."
And we started making plans right then. I think the thing that I found out about watching that movie is that in spite of everything that I had known about pilgrimage experiences throughout history, I didn't realize an average, everyday person could go on pilgrimage. I thought you had to be a member of the clergy, a monk, you know, something other than what I am. And one of the things One of the things I learned about that film, in spite of the fact that so much of that film has only a very, very tenuous relationship to what the Camino is really like, is that an ordinary person can be a pilgrim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a to even broaden that vision even more, the name of this season or this series of interviews that you're participating in on the podcast is all about adventure. And one of the reasons that I wanted to have people come on and talk about their adventures is that very reason, that people who go on adventures are people just like you and me. And they don't know necessarily if they're going to be able to cross that finish line. They think they might be able to, and they prepare and they train. They try to buy the right gear, and they talk to people who've done it before, and they hope and they pray, but they don't really know. And that is a very real experience. That's a very human experience. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, when you say that, I'm thinking to myself, I guess we thought we would finish. I mean, I don't think the idea of not finishing ever came into our heads, but it's certainly possible that we wouldn't have. I mean, when you think about it now, the idea of
walking. Didn't you know people? Did you know people on the trail that didn't finish? Because I certainly did.
Yes, we absolutely did. And we, one person in particular, Des,
right,
who we walked with for a couple of days, was having a real difficulty. And we really tried to help him along in that process and thought we had made some headway. And we found out a few days later that he had decided to turn back. So and that's hard to hear also, that someone can't, can't finish. Hopefully.
Yeah, and I think in a very human way, hearing that someone else is not going to continue, I think it sort of reveals your own, the possibility. It reveals a fault in your plan, right? It reveals the possibility that maybe something could happen that would make you turn back. You know,
yeah,
it makes you feel a little bit less
at
sure.
At the same time, I think it also maybe gives you that energy to say, "I can do it." Right. And not in a competitive sense, but in a for myself, I can do it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I wouldn't say it's fear as much as it is apprehension, a reminder that you can't, that while you're on the way, you can't think about the result. You can't think about the destination. All you can really think about is the next step that you're taking. And that, I mean, physically, the next step that you're taking, because when you can do that, it somehow becomes less intimidating, becomes less daunting that you're on this 500-mile journey across the north of Spain. No, actually, all you're doing is just walking another kilometer.
Or another step.
Yeah, and it just reminds you that you're in this place here now. A lot of people asked us, or a lot of people mentioned when we would tell them that we had gone on this pilgrimage across Spain, they all said, "Oh, the sightseeing must have been beautiful." And I don't think either one of us ever thought that there was a single moment when we were sightseeing, that it was much more that we had become part of the landscape, that we were immersed in this experience. And that's what it is to just walk step after step after step. It's completely losing yourself and yet finding your right place.
Absolutely. And it reminds me of that beautiful poem, which I'm probably not going to quote well, but I think it's Machado that says, I think he says, "Caminante, el camino se hace andando." The way or the path is created by walking, which I just love. I just love
that. That's so beautiful. You know, that reminds me of, I mentioned earlier the Thai monks that walk. I think they're from Thailand, and they don't have a monastery. They don't have a place, a home base. And I think that there's an apocryphal story about someone asking them, well, why do you walk? And the monks answer, we walk to find out why we walk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it is sort of, as I said, it's sort of losing yourself and finding your purpose all at the same time.
And it is a meditation, isn't it? It's, I mean, we'll get to this later in our conversation, you know, what each day looks like as a pilgrim on the way. But just, you know, even if you look at it in a broad sense, it really is a meditation. Meditation is a very repetitive thing. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing, you know, on a small scale with just step after step after step, mm-hmm. is a very repetitive thing. But even just the day after day after day is also a very repetitive thing.
I was just going to say, it's so interesting that you say that, because the night before we started walking, we were staying at a little place in Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, and we were having a communal dinner with the other guests that were staying in the same inn. And Susan Austin,
yeah.
Fellow peregrina from California, was there, and she described the Camino as a moving meditation, that's what it is.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. I think that that's such a mm-hmm. beautiful and perfect way to describe it,
yeah.
because that's what you...
Wow, how interesting yeah. that you had that conversation the night before you began, that you went into it with that, you know, that idea and that mindset. I can't say that about myself. That was something that came either on the trail or even after I finished. But I'd love to kind of go back to some practicalities. Mm-hmm. So you've gotten us to the point where you've decided you're going to take the trip. You both saw this wonderful movie that really touched both of you. What were the practical steps that you took as you got prepared? You live in New York, you had to gather all your gear and buy plane tickets to Spain. So what did that look like?
So I think initially we were hoping to do this as our honeymoon. Mm-hmm. And so we started preparing pretty soon after we got married. I think we started amassing some gear. We watched a lot of YouTube videos about packing, what you're supposed to pack, what everything's supposed to weigh, what the right things are. Read some books, some guidebooks, packing lists, all of those things. REI was definitely a place we were at quite frequently. And then it turned out that time frame was not going to work for us. We both ended up with some work opportunities that we didn't want to give up, which I think ultimately were the right decision.
Right, right. They were professional opportunities. You know, you remember what it was like when someone says, occasionally it still happens now, that's a job that you cannot say no to. And it was almost like the universe was saying, yes, we know you want to go on this pilgrimage, but, you know, you still have this other life as well. And and so it ended up being 3 years of delays where, it wasn't always professional opportunities. Sometimes it was, I had the right amount of time to take off, but Penny didn't have the right amount of time to take off. And it was just syncing all mm-hmm. of those things together. And it took us 3 years to finally find that window of time.
Right.
Because we wanted to do the whole thing. We didn't want to just do part of it as an introduction to the Camino. We had read so much about it. We had seen so many videos on YouTube and seen so many documentaries that we wanted to start at Saint-Jean, Pied-de-Port, and we wanted to end up at Santiago de Compostela. And we knew that that would take mm-hmm. at least 5 weeks, probably closer to six. So mm-hmm. that's a long block of time.
Right.
It is. It is.
And I think mm-hmm. I don't even think we thought about the idea of splitting it up at all. And I know as we were walking, we met so many people. I mean, I think a lot of Europeans do that breaking it up because it's a much less of a commitment travel wise, plane ticket wise, if you're in Europe. It's so much less expensive to travel.
Right. Well, and certainly for Spaniards, right. I mean, they just either right. drive up or take a train.
And just
yeah.
start walking. And for us, it was a bit more of, you know, an ordeal of logistics of getting there. And so yeah. it was, you know, once we got there, we're not leaving until we're done.
Well, if you guys don't mind, I'd love to share with you how I ended up having,
yes.
you know, 5 weeks on my schedule. Because, I mean, that really is the biggest challenge in mm-hmm. this whole thing. Like, who has that right. kind of time? I mean, you can, it's not, I mean, depending on your situation, it can be a challenge saving up the money. But it's other than the plane ticket, it's not an expensive trip to take. So really the hardest thing to come by is the time. So I, in the winter before I did the Camino, I had never heard of the Camino, and I went down to Peru to see my sister, and I hiked the Inca Trail and absolutely fell in love with it. So I come back to New York, and I go to a voice lesson with my teacher, who's a very, very spiritual woman named Sherry Anderson. I don't know if you know her. And she... said, oh, just based on your reaction, you have to do the Camino de Santiago. And I said, the what? I had never heard of it before. So this would have been, you know, January of 2001. So she gave me, here you guys are talking about how every American we ran into had seen this movie, The Way. And when I did it, everyone had read Shirley MacLaine's right. book. Right. So she handed me Shirley MacLaine's book. I took it home and read it, and I really liked it. And I thought, just like you did, I thought, someday I will do this trip. But for me, it was a big someday. I mean, I just thought, I just went to Peru. I mean, when am I going to carve out this time and save this money? So that was probably January. May rolls around, May, June, something like that. And I got a summons to serve on a grand jury. And, you know, serving on grand jury duty is 4 weeks rather than 1 week. And so at the time I didn't have a theater gig at the time. I was working in an art gallery and I had a manager who was sending me out on auditions. So I let those people know, I have jury duty. I won't be here for a month. So I show up for jury duty, and in the first 20 minutes, they had sent me home. And I went home and I thought, when is this going to happen again? And I bought a plane ticket to Spain.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Yeah. And I didn't train. I had that Shirley MacLaine book. That was my guide. I thought, well, I'll just look for the yellow arrows. And that's what
wow.
I did.
Wow.
It was crazy.
I love that story.
It's great.
But that's the Camino, isn't it? I mean, so many of us yeah. have stories like that, Camino stories like that. It's absolutely yeah. astounding how real life sort of intervenes. That's what happened to us. Ultimately,
yeah.
You know, we both had, I had a window of time available to me when we finally, you know, that window of time where we did decide to go, I had that window of time available to me. But Penny had been working on something that had been the sort of the apex of a very, very difficult professional period in
right.
your life.
I had sort of done five very challenging shows back to back, the fifth of which really, really kind of broke me a little bit. And I think I mm-hmm. was having all kinds of questions about whether or not this was what I still wanted to do and, you know, what was happening. And I really needed a break and a reset. And I think that was the moment where as soon as I knew that I was leaving that fifth show, I think we booked plane tickets. It's like, this is what we're doing.
Right.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we both mm-hmm. needed resets at yeah. that moment, and we had no idea that was going to be our reset point. We just needed to get away. We were talking about this last night. You know, it's like when you're in a confined space. Okay, living in New York, as you know, you're a confined space, and you have a roommate or a partner or whatever, and you get into an argument, and one of you said, "I just have to leave. I just have to go for a walk. I just have to walk. Mm-hmm. I'll be gone for the next half hour. I'm just walking around the block." The Camino was that block that we both needed to walk around. We didn't know what we would learn. We didn't know what we what it was going to provide. We didn't even know if we were prepared.
Right.
I'm sure we thought we did.
How aware were you at the time when you made the decision to go? You've now made the preparations. You're setting out on the journey. How aware were you of the why? Did you know why you were drawn to take that walk around the block and walk the path to Santiago?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think either so. One of us had a clue. I think we were just drawn to it. I literally, it wasn't until I said that last night that it was like leaving the apartment in a snit and having to walk around the block, that I realized that there was a big part of that involved in this. On some level, we just needed to get away, and we needed to not do whatever we had done before. It wasn't even about, you know, you can say, oh, you know, I need to get away. I'm going to go to Hawaii for 2 weeks, or I'm going to go gamble in Las Vegas, or I'm going to go camping or something like that. No, this was something we needed to think. We needed to live outside of the box. Completely. And this was one way of doing it. I'm not going to say that it was dark and fueled by anxiety, because as soon as we got on the plane, as soon as we got on the crazy van ride from Biarritz to Saint-Jean, it was an adventure.
It was definitely an adventure. Yeah. The adventure started then, for sure.
But I know for the first time in my life that there were moments where we were completely lost. When we got off the van in Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, we saw a map that was in front of the town hall that had no resemblance to reality at all. And we were trying to find our B&B. And it was great being lost. It was so exciting not knowing where we were going.
How interesting to hear you say that, because I don't know if you guys have heard the comparison of the Camino de Santiago to a labyrinth.
No.
So there are people who say that the network of paths is a bit of a labyrinth, in the sense that in a real labyrinth, as opposed to a maze, you cannot get lost. If you just take step after step, you will end up at the center, in the case of a labyrinth, right? Or you will end up at your goal. And yet, part of the beauty of that is that you can allow yourself to get lost, and you can allow yourself to have that walking meditation in a labyrinth or on the Camino de Santiago, because you can sort of relax into a knowing that you will arrive. You know, it's not like really getting lost where, you know, there's danger, unknown. You know, you can just trust that if you take step after step, you're going to get there.
You know, it's funny because there's this thing that happens on the Camino called the bed race. because there are so many pilgrims on the road, and they're particularly at the beginning of the Camino, when they're all trying to get to the next town early enough to get a place to sleep. And Penny said something really interesting on this last Camino that we did last year. She said she didn't understand the anxiety, because there will always be a place for you to sleep. And it's sort of the same thing. You just keep putting one foot in front of the other. It may not be in the albergue that you want. It may not even be in the town that you originally
thought you were going to stop in. Right.
To stop in.
Right.
But there will always be a place for you to sleep. You cannot get lost.
Yeah.
And if you embrace that, it heightens the sense of adventure. It heightens the sense of exploration, and it does.
And I think part of what I hear you saying is, you know, we all have a plan, right? We sort of map out how we think things are going to go. And I think when people get upset or afraid, it's not necessarily that something bad will happen. It's that their plan won't be realized, or that they'll have to sort of, you know, they'll have to amend the plan. But really, is that the be all and end all? Your plan?
Well,
I mean, it's just something you wrote down on paper.
And that, I think, that was one of the biggest challenges for me. And I think I was really cognizant of it on our first Camino, is that what I do for a living is plan and try to like look ahead and anticipate what the next problem is going to be, or, you know, what the next challenge is going to be. And any other time that we had traveled together, I was sort of like, you know, itinerary, we're staying this, we're seeing this, we're going to five museums, we're taking this bus tour, we're doing these things. And I really had to force myself not to do that. And it was such a freeing experience for me in that way, to just say, okay, maybe we know where we're going to get to, but I'm not planning a week ahead. I'm not planning 2 days ahead. Yeah. Like, maybe we would look the night before and say, you know, where do we think we're going to get? And maybe we got there and maybe we didn't, but it was fine.
Oh, I love that. I love hearing that. Listen, we need to take a pause for a quick break, but we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Tom and Penny. Back in a second.
Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit www.rafsanpedro.es. That's www.rafsanpedro.es.
This is Kate Jetmore with Listen. If you're just joining us, my guests today are Tom Sesma and Penny Dalton, who are sharing their experiences hiking the Camino de Santiago in Spain. Let's talk about life on the trail. Just as you told us what the Camino is at the top of our conversation, I'd love it if you could describe a typical day for us, from the time you wake up in the morning to the time you go to sleep at night. What is that?
Oh my gosh. We always got up early. We always found a place to stay. We always did our stuff, and we went to bed, and we'd start the next day the same way. We would get up around 5:30 in the morning, 6 o'clock, and we'd start walking. We would have we'd always try to make sure we had a little bite to eat. If there was no cafe, we made sure that we had some bread or some yogurt and some instant coffee. some Nescafe in our packs. Mm-hmm. We would have a quick breakfast. We would pack very quietly so we wouldn't wake up any other pilgrims. And then we'd leave when it was dark. We loved walking in the dark. We loved the solitude of walking before morning light and then feeling the sunrise on our backs. And we'd turn around, and even in the most overcast of days, we would, seeing the sun come up was really special.
Yeah, really, really amazing. And then I think, you know, about 3 to 5 kilometers in, it'd be early still, but late enough that some cafe might be open in the next town, and we would stop and actually have a proper coffee and tostada or, you know, Zuma, and just, you know, take a little break, rest our feet, and, you know, keep walking. Take another small break, maybe have, you know, a small lunch someplace, or we would take lunch with us, stop and, you know, have a little bread and cheese. And
these first two cafe stops would also be about the time that we would see other people on the road. And so we would make friends, we'd walk for a little while, sometimes in the dark, sometimes in the morning light. We'd break bread together at cafes. A sort of a pilgrim family would start to form. And this is an everyday thing, you know. Sometimes it was the same people, sometimes it was new people. But it was exciting because they were always people from, you know, some other place around the world who identified in a completely different way. But we were all doing the same thing. It was a kind of emotional and spiritual fuel that just kept you going.
You would get to where, you know, we'd figure out where we were going to stay. Usually around 2 o'clock, 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we'd get checked in to the albergue, and you know, Tom very early on sort of figured out this system that I would have been much lazier about, I know.
It was so, you know, it was very counter to the whole Camino idea because it was very, very controlling, very A-type. Penny would like to crash as soon as we'd get to wherever we were, because naturally she was tired. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, after the first couple towns that we stopped in, I realized, oh no, the first thing you have to do when you get there is you have to wash your clothes. Because remember, on the Camino, you've only taken an extra change of clothes. So, you know, you're covered with dust, you're filthy, your socks and your underwear have to be changed. So the most important thing to do as soon as you arrived was to do your laundry. Why? Because you had to hang it dry. And you had to hang it dry when the sun was still up. Because if the sun was down, your clothing was not going to dry, and it would be hanging from your bag the next morning.
Right. So. Right. That doesn't sound type A to me. That sounds like, no, it totally does. I mean, that's pilgrim thing.
Right, right.
But I was very,
I mean, it's survival. Right.
But I have to say, I was very unforgiving about it.
It's like,
let's do it.
Doing laundry, take a shower.
You can sleep in the clothes you're going to wear tomorrow. Right. Take a nap in the clothes you're going to wear tomorrow. Right. Sometimes you had to take a shower. And also, there was nothing else to do because siesta had already started and everything was closed.
Right. So it's sort of the perfect timing. It works out exactly the way that it should. That's your moment to do those things. And then once you've, you're a little refreshed, you go back out, you find some place to have dinner, or there's dinner you're making dinner with friends in the albergue, or there's some kind of a community meal if you're staying in a place that does that. And, you know, and then usually there's a pilgrim mass of some sort at one of the churches, or more than one of the churches if you're in a bigger town. And you have a little bit of community time after that. And I mean, if you're not asleep by 9 or 9:30, I don't know what you're doing because
I can't talk to you. You obviously don't understand this. So what I hear you guys saying about a typical day, and this is certainly what I experienced, is that there are kind of two parts of the Camino. There are the towns, which are sometimes tiny, tiny little hamlets, and sometimes they're big cities. Like, I mean, certainly Santiago de Compostela is a big city, but so is Burgos, and so is León, and so is
Astorga,
Estella, Logroño, Astorga.
Yep.
Yeah. Where?
And then you've got the path that strings these towns together.
Right.
And so what you do all day is you walk from one town to the next. You walk from one shelter to the next. So these shelters are called refugios, or in Spanish, albergues. And that's where you sleep each night. Some of these are public. Some of them are private. And, of course, there are hotels along the way, too. I would really love to hear your impressions of the different types of options when it comes to where you sleep at night, and which of the options you came to prefer.
There were three major kinds of albergues where we stayed. Municipals, which are usually larger institutions that are run by the towns. And there are private albergues, which are just sometimes privately owned inns, hostels. And then there are parochial.
Or donativos,
which are usually associated with the church. Sometimes they're in monasteries or abbeys. Sometimes they're just freestanding albergues that are run by associations from confraternities, of pilgrim confraternities from other countries. The municipals tend to be very, very big. Lots of pilgrims will stay there. Privates tend to be very small. So, for instance, you can stay in a municipal and be in a big room with 75 other pilgrims. At a private albergue, you can be in a small room with three other pilgrims.
And the municipals tend to be a little less expensive than the privates as well.
Yeah, the privates tended to be much nicer because they're in competition with other places. I'm not saying that they're really commercial or really business oriented because they are serving the purpose. I mean, they're not in a profit making business. They're opening their doors to pilgrims, and they're making things as nice as possible as they can. You know, some of them back then in 2016, not every albergue had Wi-Fi or Wi-Fi, for instance. Now, I'd say most of them do. But it was the smaller places.
Right. And the Donativas, I think, sort of became our preferred places. I think it just, they had the sense, sort of the sensibility that we felt more comfortable with, and the types of people who were staying there were the types of people we were making friends with, I think.
Right. They were called donativos because you pay what you can. And you sort of pay it forward, because what you're paying, and we would usually pay the prevailing rate, you know, whatever we would be paying anywhere else, pays for the pilgrims the next day. It takes care of their food. It pays their bills. And so it was our way of being part of the road, part of the way. And sustaining that pilgrim family.
Did you happen to stay at San Nicolas, which is run by an Italian association?
We did not stay at San Nicolas. We stayed, I can't remember what was before that. I mean, we stayed
at Hades.
Right. We had stayed at San Anton the first time, which is, I think, has a sort of similar feel to San Nicolas. And so we didn't have an opportunity to stay there. And this last time we did go in and stop and have tea and biscuits there.
Yes. So many of our friends stayed at San Nicolas
and really loved it.
We felt like
it's sort of a strange, I remember it being a very strange
space. Yes, it is weird.
I think the day that I slept there, I think I only walked like 12 kilometers or something. It's not a comfortable place to end your etapa. But on that day, I was walking with an Italian man, and so he was like friends with the people who ran it or something. And so he had known from the beginning of his Camino that he would be staying there. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll stay there too. And they had this lovely washing of the feet ritual. And I think they only had like 12 beds or some crazy, crazy low number. And I remember sitting there in the doorway, and this man, I don't even know if he slept there or if he was just walking by, but he was one of these people who I'm sure both of you have encountered on the Camino, who probably started in like Austria. And he was hiking in his Teva sandals, and he was probably 70 years old, and his calves were just ropey. And he had a backpack that looked like, you know, a kid's school backpack. And he was walking by, and I was just like sitting on the stoop reading or writing in my journal or something. And we didn't talk. I don't even know if we spoke the same language, but I will never forget the look in that man's eye. He looked like a monk. I mean, he looked like somebody who'd been alone with his thoughts for several months.
Yeah.
And then after, on that same day, that same evening, I had I don't want to say if it was a vision. It definitely wasn't a vision in the sense that there was nothing that I saw, but it was like a message that I received. And you might say it was a message from God. I don't know, but it was a message that I received. And the message was, you will help people.
Oh.
And so I've always associated that with San Nicolas and definitely with the Camino. And for many years in my life, I felt really guilty, like, what are you doing? You're supposed to be helping people. You know, why aren't you becoming a psychologist? Or, you know, why aren't you becoming a chaplain? And over the years, it's mellowed into this wonderful knowing that, you know, helping people is holding doors and listening to them and holding space.
Right. It's what we do. It's just, There's a great line in, it's an old comedy, I can't remember, but the protagonist is visited by aliens at a really, really difficult point in his life. He's very suicidal, and he says, "I feel like I've wasted my life. Shouldn't I be helping people? Shouldn't I be doing missionary work?" And the alien looks at him and said, "Listen to me. Trust me on this. You are not the missionary type." And the alien says, "You want to help people? Be a better person." You know, and sometimes that's all it is. Right. Mm-hmm. It's one of the lessons of the Camino is that sometimes the solutions are just the simplest. The thing we can do best for the world is sometimes just being a better person.
Well, what about, I'd love to hear about some of your most special moments on the Camino. You've already shared some of them, but you know, when you look within and you think, you know, what are the moments that really stayed with me, or the people who really stayed with me, what would those be?
We have a lifelong friendship now with a peregrina that we met on the very, very first day that we started. Her name is Pam Johnson. She's a classics professor at a small college near Fresno. We were walking out early in the morning. It was around 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, still dark, from the gate at Saint-Jean-Pierre-de-Port to...
Your very first morning.
And we were going to take the Route Napoleon over the Pyrenees, past Orizon into Roncesvalles. And we saw a woman... in the dark, reading a guidebook by lamplight, and she didn't have a headlamp. We both had our headlamps, and so she asked if she could walk with us for a little while. And we said, sure, and we started chatting, and we walked for most of that day together, and we became very, very fast friends. We lost her when we...
Yeah, that evening, I think we lost her.
That evening in the rush of...
Just
in the crowd. I think she got ahead of us at some moment. And then she ended up upstairs at Roncesvalles, and we ended up in the basement. And then we didn't see her again. And then a week later, I think we were walking into Logroño. We were about to stay at the first Donativo that we would have had the opportunity to stay at.
But incidentally, I have to throw in, too, that we talked about Pam a lot, almost every day. Right. And we talked about, gosh, I hope we meet more people like Pam. She was such a special person.
Or I wonder if we'll ever see Pam again.
Right.
And literally walking into Logroño up to the place where we wanted to stay. It hadn't opened yet. And there was a line of people and backpacks out front. And who was the first person on the line? Pam.
Yelling our names.
We were so excited to see her. And we ended up walking with her for every day for the next week. And until we got to Burgos, and she stayed at Emmaus, and we had already made plans to have a rest day in Burgos. She wasn't taking a rest day. And so then she was ahead of us again. And we sort of had that same feeling of, oh, we're never going to see her again.
But for the remainder of the Camino, we continued to try to reach out to her via text message and things like that. We weren't very digital in 2016. Mm-hmm. But occasionally, every few days, we would check out guest registers at certain albergues. We would find out that she stayed there 2 days before, you know. And then we were talking about how pilgrims often leave messages for each other. You know, people who are walking ahead of you will leave a note, or they'll scrawl some graffiti, which they shouldn't do, or they'll even write your name in small pebbles on the road. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think we were both sad that no one had ever done anything like that for us, because we had met so many nice people. And then we saw this little scrap of yellow paper pinned to a stone wall, and it had the letters DFTBA, which stands for Don't Forget to Be Awesome. That is Pam's motto, and those letters were written on her scallop shell. So we thought, I wonder if Pam has been here. That's interesting. Then we walked on a few more kilometers, and we see another scrap of paper. And it said DFTBA, Tom and Penny. So clearly, Pam was
had
ahead
been
of
there.
Us.
Right.
We figured she left this messages for us 2 days before. We finally get to this little town called Santa Irena, where we're going to stay that night. Sidebar. Pam had sent me a text message to ask where we were staying
on that night before.
We told her we're staying at the Rural Astar in Santa Irene. And then I said, where are you? And she replied with this cryptic message, oh, I'm in Spain. I'm walking the Camino de Santiago.
Oh, I know that.
All right.
That.
Okay. Yeah, but that's the last we heard from her. So we get to the crossroads leading to Santa Irén. For us to get to Rural Astar, we have to turn to the left, and there's a stop sign. And on that stop sign are three pieces of paper. DFTBA, Penny and Tom, and then below that, it's Pam, I'm staying at the Rural Astar, turn left. And we hear this screaming and yelling from a banshee across the busy intersection. And there is Pam, nursing a beer, waving her arms, yelling our names. And we had a homecoming.
Yeah. And she said to us, she said, we started together, we're going to finish together. And so she had basically slowed down, and we walked into Santiago, hand in hand, the three of us.
The very next day.
Sobbing. It was amazing.
Oh, my goodness.
So
that's just full circle.
Yeah.
I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah, it was really wonderful.
There were a number of other small things that happened, in 2019... We met this wonderful Italian man who lives in Vancouver, of all places, named Giorgio. And we would run into him periodically. We really liked Giorgio. He had a
great energy about him. And he had walked, he had walked part of the Camino before.
He's like a variety show MC. that's not what he does for a living. That's his personality.
But
we hadn't seen him for, I think, 10 days. Which is the longest period of time we hadn't seen Giorgio. And so it was our very last day in Santiago before we headed home. And we were walking out of a gift shop, and we said, I wonder if we'll ever see Giorgio again. We walk out into the street, and he's standing there staring
right there.
At us. It was... we had so many experiences like that on the Camino, but I don't think that those were... special just for us. I think it happens to everybody all the time.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things the Camino teaches you is that you just have to be available to those moments where you see things. They say explanations for miracles or people who see angels are actually very simple. Angels and miracles happen all the time. We just don't pay attention. And I think that those are the kinds of special things that happen to us on the Camino.
Well, I absolutely agree with that, that it's all around you, but you are in control of whether your eyes are open or not, or which direction you're looking in. What about, were there tough moments on the trail? Were there moments that tested you either as individuals or as a couple or physically? Any of those moments that you can share?
I think we both definitely had a couple of physical challenges more than anything else. I don't think we had a lot of challenges as a couple.
We had two serious challenges as a couple where for whatever reasons we just, it's sort of like being in a confined space.
Yeah.
It's sort of like being under coronavirus lockdown where you have moments where you're just sick of seeing that other person's face, even if they're trying to be really nice to you, something happens. Yes. So those moments happened. I mean, twice, but I think that there were two, of us had a moment when the Camino,
really physically challenged us. And oddly, I mean, for me, I think it was the day after we had taken another rest day in León, and the day that we started back, for whatever reason, and we were, it was completely flat, like easy terrain, and my legs did not want to move. Like, I felt like it was taking an hour to walk a kilometer. And I still have absolutely no explanation for it. It was so frustrating.
I remember getting up that morning because we had had that extra day of rest in León, and we loved León. We loved our time there. And when we started walking that morning, we both felt really, really terrific.
Yeah. And then suddenly I just had there was a disconnect. And it was the one time where I just said to Tom, I was like, you have to just go ahead of me. like, I'll find you at a bar somewhere or whatever, but I can't hold you up like this, and I can't have someone next to me while I'm doing this. It just, it was hard. And we got to the next stopping point and took a break, and then it was fine.
Mm-hmm. I had my moment the day we got to the Cruz de Ferro. We dropped our pebbles, right? And we started heading down the hill to through Acebo and then to Molino Seca. And that descent from Acebo to Molino Seca is treacherous. I think a lot of pilgrims consider it the hardest part of the Camino. And I think it's hard for a lot of different reasons.
I just remember a lot of loose stones and like a lot of dangerous moments where you could just, you know, twist
completely
your ankle.
Wipe out.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that that happens. I think this happens to a lot of peregrinos, that you feel such a sense of triumph when you drop that little pebble off at the Cruz de Ferro that, you know, you're two thirds of the way, three quarters of the way through the Camino. You feel like you've accomplished something, that you've become a pilgrim, and all of a sudden the Camino takes over and says, no, you're not done. This is really hard. And I remember looking at Penny at a certain point. I was almost crying. And I said, I just want to get off this mountain and go home. That thought came out of nowhere. At no point in the previous almost four weeks had I said anything like that. That I had had it ever occurred to me that I couldn't finish. And it occurred to me that day. It was really, really difficult. And I realized that, you know, that I had gotten complacent about the Camino, that somehow you just relax into this idea that a pilgrimage is easy, that spiritual transformation or whatever it is that could be happening to you, that epiphanies are easy. Well, no, they're not. They really force you to question your sense of self, your identity, your ability, what you set out to do.
Getting out of your comfort zone is uncomfortable, as they say. Well, you know, leading up to this conversation, you both shared something with me, which was that when you came back in 2019 to hike the Camino again, that your experience was quite different. Can you share with us a little bit about how those two experiences compared? And let's start with that. How would you describe your second time on the Camino?
Well, first, we decided to start a little bit differently the second time because I think we felt like I'm not sure we ever need to walk the Route Napoleon a second time. It was a challenge that we undertook, and that once was definitely enough. And we had read a little bit about sort of a newer, less walked route called the Camino Baztán, which starts in Bayonne. Mm-hmm. And we thought that would be an interesting thing to try. So that was our first 5 days. And amazingly, that entire time, we met two other pilgrims. That was it.
In five days.
That's 100 kilometers.
Both of whom were Spaniards, neither of whom spoke any English. So that was a big challenge for us. But, you know, we still keep in touch with them as, you know, thank you, Google Translate. And
and it was interesting also to walk a part of the Camino that's not in Spain. So for the first two days.
Yeah, 2 days, right? 2.5 days.
You're just walking through France where it's very... it's a different experience because, first of all, the Camino is not the Baztán is not well traveled, so you're meeting a lot of people who are just looking at you. Why are you walking through our town with backpacks?
Right.
The trails are not necessarily well waymarked. I joke that they're indifferently waymarked in that very French way, but. I think we got lost twice.
We did get lost twice
because once you cross the border into Spain, all of a sudden there were waymarks everywhere, almost like they had a sail on yellow paint, and they were just like drawing yellow arrows everywhere. But the oddest thing was walking this entire path and only meeting two other pilgrims.
Right. And then I think, you know, and we had started a bit later than we did in 2016 in the hopes that that there would be fewer people in general. I mean, both times we eventually, you know, we were on the Camino Frances, which is the busiest, most mm-hmm. traveled route. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, approaching next year's Holy Year. And it mm-hmm. was so busy in 2016 that we thought, oh, well, we'll go later. We'll start this other way. When we get to, you know, to Pamplona or Trinidad de Are, which is right outside of Pamplona, it won't be as crowded. And mm-hmm. we were mistaken. And it was mm-hmm. as crowded, if not more crowded. And so, mm-hmm. you know, we sort of were, you know, jump-started into this, into the bed race and into the crowds of people. And mm-hmm. and it was a...
Which is exactly what we were trying to avoid.
It was a little bit of a shock, mm-hmm. I think, to both of us mm-hmm. And a little overwhelming. And then that's when we realized, too, how many other things just in this short 3-year period had changed. I mean, so many mm. more people are booking accommodations ahead. So mm. many more people are having their backpacks transferred from place to place, so they're not carrying the full weight of their packs. And
like there's a service that has a van.
Right, there are a couple of different services, as well as the post office also does it. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a little bit of that in 2016, but it was mostly if someone was injured or really having a difficult time. And this time it felt much more like a convenience for a lot of people, which was a little confusing mm-hmm. to us. I mean, I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you know, sometimes we go, not just sometimes, regularly we go on the Camino forums, and a lot of times there will be posts from people who are planning their first Camino, and one of the first questions most people seem to be asking these days is, what are the best baggage transfer companies? As if that's the thing to do now. But I think the other thing that really changed, that really struck us about the change, is that back in 2016, most people were using guidebooks. They were using the Wise right. Pilgrim right. guidebooks or the Brearley book or Shirley MacLaine's book. But you would mm-hmm. refer to the book, then you would walk with other pilgrims. There would be a community of people, a sea of people. But now I think most pilgrims are referring to apps. Most people are using their mobile devices, and like everywhere mm-hmm. else, New York City, Madrid, you have all of these people who are completely focused on their mobile device the entire time. So there's not a sense of, there's not the same immediate sense of community. Is there a sense of community? Yeah. Yes, there is. It just takes much longer to develop.
When I did the Camino, and I have been back a couple of times, but I've never done it in its entirety. Mm-hmm. Only in 2001 did I do it in its entirety. And just because I did have a cell phone at the time, but it didn't have international coverage, and that really wasn't a thing that anyone could afford at the time. So I just left my cell phone at home because it wasn't going to work in Spain, and I hiked the trail without... Yeah. a phone. And then from time to time, I would like feed coins into a payphone and call and let people know I was okay. But the man who's now my husband, who I met on the trail, he's Spanish. And so he was in Spain and he hiked with his cell phone. And I remember one time we were sort of razzing each other and I said, you know, real pilgrims don't hike with a phone. And he said, I'll never forget this. He said, real pilgrims don't hike with shoes.
Oh my God.
So, which was a real wake-up right. call for me, because it's all relative, yeah. you know? I mean, I would definitely fall in your camp, which is real pilgrims don't use apps, you know?
Right.
But it's like, you really can peel back all those layers and say, well, real pilgrims are missing half their teeth. Yes.
Well, you know, I mean, but that's so interesting, because that's exactly the conclusion we came to. There were lots of issues with the 2019 Camino. The fact that it had become more commercial. The fact that the Camino, particularly the Camino Frances, has become more transactional than transformative. That these things don't change the fact that that we as individuals are on pilgrimages. It's my pilgrimage. Yeah. It's my Camino. These are hardships. These are challenges that I have to face. Okay, so now you're not dealing with an interactive community, family of pilgrims in the same way that you did 3 years ago. But that doesn't, that's like a detour. That's all.
Yeah.
That's like a bridge being out. It's like.
And also on a very personal level, it sort of shines a light on judgment.
Right. Right. Exactly.
You know, it's like another personal challenge as you're walking along. You know, how do you interact with people who are doing things that you personally wouldn't do, or that you find yourself what is it thinking? That you know, you find yourself.
Well, judging. You always just say, I mean, everybody's on their own Camino. Right. They're not on mine. I'm not on theirs. And it's, it's working for them. Right. I mean, they have to figure that out in the same way that we have to figure it out.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Well, listen, we need to take another short break and we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Penny Dalton and Tom Sesma. We love your feedback. Let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. Subscribe to our podcast if you haven't already. Rate, review, and share, and be sure to recommend us to your friends and colleagues. You can find us on social media and check out the new Listen blog on our website at thelistenpodcast.com. Today we're talking with Tom Sesma and Penny Dalton about their hiking adventures, specifically their experiences in Spain on the Camino de Santiago. I'd love to talk a little bit about the phenomenon known as Camino magic. What's that?
Oh, there's so many different ways to describe that, right? I mean, part of it is what we were talking about before, about sort of conjuring up people we haven't seen.
Yeah, there were so many... when we were on the 2019 Camino, we changed up so many things because we wanted to do it differently. We didn't want to struggle with expectations of repeating experiences that we had before. And sometimes those changes came at the last minute and they were the result of disappointment, like the place we wanted to stay wasn't available, or it was available but this wasn't in our plan for the steps that we wanted to take that day. And somehow everything that could have been disappointed ended up being magically better. There was a blessing of some kind.
Right.
In 2016, we stayed at San Anton, which is, it's an albergue built into the ruins of an abandoned monastery. Right?
From convent,
convent. It was one of the most transformative, beautiful Camino magic experiences. We've remained friends with many of the people that we met there that night, having our candlelight dinner, our communal candlelight dinner. And we were very lucky because there are only 11 bunks at San Anton.
11 beds.
11 beds, right. So we got there this year thinking that it was closed. All of the guides, all of the apps said it was that it closed on a particular date. Well, they were staying open. And we had planned not to stay there. And
We sort of had a moment of, wait, they're open. Should we stay?
Should we stay
do this
here?
Again?
Because and we decided not to. We decided that we had our time at this very, very special place and that we were going to leave it for some pilgrims whom we hadn't met. And so they could have the same experience. Two or three towns later, we found out that they were full that night. They had been full that night after we left. And the people that took those spaces were people that we had met on the Camino earlier. And it was like a gift that we had been able to give them.
Right.
Yeah, it absolutely is a gift. I would love to know what you think about whether that kind of energy, that kind of very special, almost magical energy, can be found off the trail, or if it is specific to the Camino de Santiago.
There's an old Yiddish term. It's called a mitzvah. When you do someone, or you send out a blessing into the world, for absolutely no reason, with no expectation of any kind of return, it just seems like the right thing to do. That Yiddishism sort of is proof that this kind of energy exists out there. I think it gets back to that idea of there are angels everywhere and you just have to be available to them.
So maybe on the trail, you're sort of more in the habit of keeping your eyes open and looking around for them than you are in real life.
I think in many respects, it's because you're surrounded by it every day. And that was particularly true in 2016, that you're surrounded by the same sorts of people. I said earlier that these are people from all around the world, from all different walks of life, who don't even speak your language. But here you are. You're in the same place. You're going to the same place. You're doing it in the same way. All you're doing is walking. And yet you're reminded of this common humanity that you all have. How could that not make you more available to things? How could that not make you more present?
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
Do you think that is the energy or do you think that's the thing that makes the Camino such a special place and such a special experience? Or would you describe it in another way?
I think that's a lot of it. I think, you know, the idea that, you know, people from different countries, from different walks of life. I mean, the thing that I found really interesting, especially in 2016, is you rarely ever talk about what you do in real life.
In the real world.
Right?
That
just doesn't. It doesn't really come up. It's not important. Like the question that always gets asked is, you know, why are you walking the Camino, right? Or where did you start from? Or, you know, whatever all of those questions are. But
or how are you feeling?
Exactly. but it's not about, you know, however else you identify yourself, which I think is a really sort of leveling idea.
And I think that one of the things that happens is that you bring that back with you, or you want to bring it back.
Right.
You know, I think that that's why I think that's why this final stage of the Camino, you know, I would say that it happens from that descent down that mountain from the Cruz de Ferro. Why that last part of the Camino from there to Santiago becomes so quiet and so reflective for a lot of people, because, you know, pilgrims realize you're coming to an end, that in a matter of days, you won't be walking anymore. And yet you've been rewarded so much on a very deep, personal, spiritual, and emotional level by simply walking every day. How do you continue to walk in the real world? How do you continue to keep the spirit of the Camino alive in the real world? I don't know that there's an answer to that. I think that there's just this question of, I mean, pilgrims say it to each other all the time. You take the Camino with you.
Right.
That's how you keep it alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It means different things for different people. But I know that, for instance, in a very practical sense, when I got back to New York, it was just a few weeks later, and I was in rehearsal for a new play, and I noticed that I was working in a completely different way. That you know, actors talk about being in the moment all the time. You know that you know that cliche. And usually it just means being fast, being able to respond quickly. What I found out was that before I went in the Camino, I was never really present. I was never really in the moment. And all of a sudden, my process, my personal process, became slower. It became more reflective. It became more generous. I was suddenly able to really receive what other actors and what the director and what the designers were doing. And I was able to find my place in it in a more thoughtful and organic way. And I was feeling better about my work.
That's
just in a practical sense. And you could take that outside and say, walking down the street here in New York City, all of a sudden you're more aware of things. You're more aware of who you are, you know. Not necessarily where you're going beyond the next step.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Penny, how would you say the Camino changed you?
Well, I think it definitely gave me the reset that I needed. I did come back and did go back into being a company manager, but I think I am much more aware of wanting to take opportunities that are going to be really rewarding for me, which I know sort of maybe sounds a little selfish, but at the same time, I think I just realized how important it is for me to be fulfilled in the things that I'm doing in my career in order to make my life better.
Yeah. And that doesn't sound selfish at all. It sounds like asking yourself, do I really want to do this?
And I think a lot
it's not a luxury we give ourselves very often, but it's really, you know, essential.
Right. And I think being able to break that down and not just be like, I have to take this next job because if I don't take this job, I'm not going to have another job. To be able to step back from it and say, you know, this is happening at this moment for this reason, that sort of gave me the vocabulary to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Penny and Tom, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. And I wish you both all the best.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to be here. And it's so great to see you again and to talk to you at length after all these years. And when we're back in Spain, we will definitely see you in person.
Please
Absolutely.
Do. Please do.
Buen camino.
Buen camino. This concludes our series of interviews focusing on adventure. Many thanks to Aitz Remelk, Kathleen Urizar, Sarah Turman, Penny Dalton, and Tom Sesma for their generous contributions. Next time on Listen, we'll kick off Season 6 with a series of conversations on writers and writing. Hope you can join us. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, where Holy Week was suspended this year for the first time since the Spanish Civil War. Check out our archives at thelistenpodcast.com. There are 4 full seasons waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. Lauren Lovett is our producer. Caitlin Fisher handles our social media, and Lidia Munoz Solera writes our blog. Tech support and original music are courtesy of Lucas Munoz Jetmore. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is Listen.